Good evening, Chodesh Tov, and welcome to our second Teiku event of the semester. Teiku's mission is to foster intellectual discourse among the students of Yeshiva University in the realms of Jewish community, faith, and current events. We hope that this evening's conversation stimulates your mind and leaves you thinking. In the familiar Perek Chav Zayin of Tehillim, David asks of Hashem, Achat sha'alti meit Hashem ota avakesh, shivti v'vet Hashem kol yimei chayai, lachazot b'noam Hashem ulvaker b'heichalo. One thing I have asked of the Lord, that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the graciousness of the Lord, and to visit his early temple. Here at Yeshiva University, the Beit Midrash continues, as David desires, to serve as the spiritual and intellectual center of our pursuit of God's wisdom. Tonight's event will explore how this age-old model of the Beit Midrash manifests itself in the 21st century modern Orthodox institutions. We have the honor this evening of hearing from two distinguished rabbis about the topic at hand. Rav David Miller served as Rosh Kollel at Yeshiva University's Gris Kollel in Israel since its inception in 1976. He is now the Mashkiach Ruchani here on Yeshiva University's Wolf campus. Rabbi David Silber, who received his smicha from Ritz, is the founder and dean of the Drisha Institute for Jewish Education. Drisha is a center for high-level Jewish learning for men and women of all ages. They have specifically pioneered in advancing learning opportunities for women. Drisha has a number of upcoming events that are appropriate for college and post-college men and women. Opportunities include winter break learning programs, summer programs, as well as full-time opportunities during the upcoming spring and fall semesters. Additionally, this Sunday, Drisha is holding a Global Day of Learning in Midtown. If anyone would like to hear more information about any of Drisha's programs, please see Nisa after the event. I would like to thank our speakers and all of you again for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the event.
That was Josh Bowenick, my co-president of Teiku, and in the back is Hillel Gross, other co-president on the Wealth Campus. My name is Rachel Weber. We're lucky to have two speakers here who have very distinct backgrounds. We're looking forward to exploring together where their ideas converge and where they diverge. Our goal is to hear insights based on personal experiences and for us to gain new perspectives on issues we may have been grappling with for years. The title of our event is Shifti B'Beit Hashem. Ruth Miller, can you tell us at what point you decided that the world of the Beit Midrash would be your life's work? What about the Beit Midrash attracted you? Oh, by the way, we're going to try to keep responses to around 4 minutes so that we can get as many questions as possible and have time for questions from the crowd at the end. So, in that area, we'll be great. Thank you, God.
Thank you very much. Let me just, before beginning, point out a point of convergence of myself and Rabbi Silber. We learned together here in the Beit Midrash in YU in our youth, and I want to thank you. This is the first time we've been in physical contact, one with the other, in over 40 years. That, to a certain degree, is to come to answer your question. Over 40 years ago, I made Aliyah, and it was a decision that I had taken years earlier. But I really had no idea what I would do in Israel. I knew what I wanted to do had I remained in America. Had I remained in America, I would have looked for a shul that was close to a college campus and would have wanted to work with the Jewish community in those two areas. But in Eretz Yisrael, that opportunity didn't and still doesn't really exist. And so my going to the Beit Midrash was really after looking into Israel and seeing that which did exist, in which I would be able to have some sort of influence on fellow Jews, and coming to the conclusion that there is no place like home. Coming to the conclusion that that really the Beit Midrash in which I grew up probably would be the best model for me to be able to have a connection with fellow Jews. And in that respect, to a large degree, it's sort of like being a link in a tradition. And when one goes back and learns Gemara, one sort of feels the Midrash in the Gemara. One feels the give and the take. One feels the Shakel Vitaria. One feels a sense of a community, and a community over generations moving from the Gemara through the Rishon or through the Achronim. And I certainly do not regret the choice in any which way. And but it's something. It's a feeling of which is very reinvigorating to me. I think I became younger since I came to YU and have a Beit Midrash of a good few hundred Talmidim as opposed to the in Grus having a smaller amount.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Rabbi Silver, can you tell us about your experience?
I would say that one of the turning points was certainly after high school. I went to Israel, went to Karen Biavna. Rabbi Miller's brother was also with me at Karen Biavna. And I think that experience got me very deeply engaged in learning Torah. So then I started at Yeshiva University, and I had only two rabbis at Yeshiva University, two excellent. I had Rabbi Lichtenstein and Rabbi Soloveitchik were my rabbis for 7 years, and I really loved to learn. And I would say it's true of myself and at least the chevra I was with. None of us actually cared so much about teaching, actually. We cared about learning. We said to ourselves, unless we go into teaching, we won't be able to keep learning. So that's why our chevra, for the most part, went into either teaching shiurim or somewhere into rabbanus. The downside is some of us probably can't teach. That's another story. But hopefully improve over time. And it was a connection to the, initially a connection to the study of Torah, which I was also fostered by my parents. But, you know, I wanted to stay inside a place of learning. I love teaching, and I like teaching young people. People especially who are starting their own path. And that was the impetus. I would add a detail which most people don't know, and that is that in 1978 I received a call from the founder of what's called JSS in those days, or JSP, I forget what was initially called, Rabbi Besdin, Olav HaShalom, that Yeshiva University was starting a program in California, it was called YULA, and he was offered to be the administrator of YULA, and he asked me if I'd be the Rosh Yeshiva. At that time I was unofficially engaged, so I spoke to my fiance, now my wife, and I called them back a week later and I said, we're going. And he said, well, it's off, you can't go. And I can't tell you why. He was extremely ish yashar. So he said, I can't tell you, it didn't do with you, he said. What happened that week, he had gone to Boston General Hospital. He was diagnosed with a very serious heart ailment from which he actually died sometime after that. And when that fell apart, I was sort of his guy, and then they chose someone else. And I started Drisha in 1979, actually. So it was, in some sense, by default. I mean, let's put it this way, that wasn't my plan. I always wondered what would have happened had I gone to YULA, had a very different life, but I don't regret that. But so I started Drisha, and the reason was there was not a market out there. I had no job. That was but over time, I think I sort of became very deeply connected to the students and with a desire to allow them to move forward in terms of Torah. So that's, I guess, in a nutshell, how it all began.
Thank you. That leads perfectly into the next question we had for you, because in 1979, when you did found the Jewish Institute for Jewish Education, you clearly perceived a lack in the world of Jewish education, that there was a need for a Beit Midrash like that. Would you be able to tell us about that lack, and 30 years later, do you perceive the same problem in the world of Jewish education, the same need, or would you choose to focus your energies elsewhere if you were beginning that path again now?
Well, as I said, the original choice was more, I needed a job. Let's just be very straight about it. But it's something that when you get involved and you have to remember, in those days, unlike today, actually many of the day schools, the graduates of high school, boys and girls who finish high school, often go to Israel for a year to learn. That was not true when I went to Karen Biavna, say, in 66. That was certainly not true of the guys. It was certainly not true of these young women. That was unusual to go to learn for a year. So around 1979, there were more of these high school graduates, the women, going to Israel to learn, returning, needing a place to learn, etc. So it seemed like it was a great opportunity to both teach on a relatively good level. The Gemara learning was not the strongest because they didn't have the opportunities to learn Gemara in those days. But to some extent, that's changed. I don't think it's changed sufficiently, but it's changed. There are many more opportunities. So it's something that when you begin, let me make the following observation, just one brief observation. In 1984, I started a kollel for women. It was like starting a kollel for Martians, basically. In other words, it wasn't that there was no one was banging down my door saying, we need a kollel for women in 1984, believe me. But if you ask me, was there a need, I say yes, there was a need. It was a need, an unspoken need, maybe an unrecognized need. But the need is to give everybody who wants to learn Torah every opportunity to do so. And it wasn't a feminist statement at the time, maybe in retrospect, but it wasn't about, it was just, it was the next step. We started with the spring semester, the fall semester, then we had summers in 1981, and the next step was an opportunity for full-time learning, which we started in 84. So I guess what happens is when you get involved in some kind of a cause and you deal with people, I'm sure Rabbi Miller, his work, sees this all the time. You deal with people, the first thing you deal with their problems. You try to move people forward in this world, in the world of Torah, and especially in a world where it's not really just about them learning and their own self-fulfillment, but optimally, it's about them giving back to the larger Jewish community as teachers, as, in terms of family, teaching in schools, etc. One of the big lacks we have in this country, certainly, Israel's a little different, but we don't have enough good teachers. So there was another opportunity to be of service to the larger Jewish community. When you have such an opportunity, I think you grab it. So that's how it, I think that's the short answer to it.
Perfect. And so now, 30 years later, where do you see those issues as having moved forward, or do you see them still as having?
Well, I don't think we've achieved any kind of parity. Not that parity is the goal. The goal is to have good education for everybody. I think there are many more opportunities. I think Drisha did do a service in terms of putting out their possibilities, which others have picked up, including Yeshiva University and programs in Israel, certainly. I would say our present focus at Drisha, we continue to try to give women opportunities to learn Torah, but I think that one thing that institutions should try to do is to figure out what is needed at the time. Kalbach used to have an expression, the mitzvah of the moment. And briefly, I would say what changed in this country was about 15 years ago, many more of these high school graduates went to learn. And when they came back to various campuses, let's leave Yeshiva University out of it, that's different, but they went to Penn, they went to Columbia, they went to Brandeis or whatever, they began on campus to create learning programs. Those programs were all co-ed. So your student who goes, say, to Penn for 3 years is learning in the Beit Midrash Sunday night. There's 100 kids there. So they're used to the co-ed. Co-ed learning for them is totally natural. That's normal. It became normal. Why is a different story, but for you, and you had a lot of these returnees from Israel. So for them, I think the co-ed is actually a positive, and many of the stronger young women prefer it because they want to be in the same playing field, the same opportunities, etc., the same challenges. So I think that our focus, in addition to continuing the struggle to give women equal access and equal opportunity, with the goal of allowing them to be servants and to serve the community, in addition to their own religious fulfillment, the focus of the last few years has been on college students, high school college students, high school girls, college men and women, etc. And you know, you're always trying to figure out where you can make the best contribution. That's what institutions should be about. I'm not saying we always succeed in that, but the thinking is where can we make our little Drisha, where can they make this contribution? So we're always reevaluating.
Okay. Rick Miller, when you look at the world of today's Torah learning, where do you see a place to make a contribution or a place to move forward in that sense?
The world is constantly changing, and people are changing, and their focus is changing. And I think a person has to sort of be with his finger on the pulse in terms of what is motivating students, in terms of what aspect of Torah learning is not in terms of a fashion or a vogue, but simply something which is built somewhat into the atmosphere, is talking to students. In that respect, I think Israel is a few steps ahead of America, namely that there is a spiritual revolution that simply one feels in the world, not only in the Jewish world, a search for spirituality, a search for something that'll touch a soul, a learning that would be more organic. In Eretz Yisrael, that's already a given. It's a question simply of how practically to facilitate it. In America, things are, at least I can only speak about the modern Orthodox world, things are evolving a little more slowly. It's one of the reasons why I came from Yerushalayim to New York, in order to help the students who are here relive or continue the experience they had in Israel, that which touched them wasn't only the learning of the head, that they, I think, there are wonderful, wonderful institutions here, but it was the learning of the soul, in addition to the learning of the head, and to bring that together, to have more of a dialogue with God. So I think that educators would be meaningful for them to sort of have a feel of what talks to the students, of where you see a shine in the eye, where you can see a more natural growth, and to take advantage of that which HaKadosh Baruch Hu has sort of placed in potential and to try and actualize it.
Okay. Rabbi Silver also mentioned his experience in Co-ed Batei Midrash and in the world of learning for women. As someone whose main experience has been in Batei Midrash that are exclusively male, what's your perspective on those types of issues?
I have a rule that I'd like to speak about what I do rather than speak about what someone else is doing. I think there are many approaches. I think that there are many directions. I feel that that once one has chosen a direction, one should do it as in the best possible manner. So in terms of Rabbi Silver, I could say my mother studied in Drisha. Once upon a time, when someone lived in Israel and his mother lived in America, they used to write letters. So she used to write me letters about how she enjoyed the intellectual stimulation and the content of what she received. And so I have Hakarat HaTov, certainly to Rav David on a very, very personal plane. In terms of an all-men's base medrash, here one has to think about what is the goal of the Beit Midrash. Namely, I've been involved for the last 35 years dealing with smicha students. So I try to think of what I would want a rabbi to know and build that into the curriculum. In YU in general, not everyone is going to be a rabbi, and so one has to think, what should an educated Jew know in America? And that's what would determine the curriculum and would determine to a certain degree also the teaching style. So it's a question really of trying to understand to whom one is speaking, where one wants to get them, and then to arrange the curriculum in that direction.
Okay, perfect. And that's incredibly also the next question we wanted to ask, because for hundreds of years at least, the traditional model of a Beit Midrash has been mostly Gemara oriented. Rabbi Silver, do you think that this model is still relevant for right now? If not, how would you envision a learning curriculum? And if you could also speak a little bit towards the way college students or post-college students with a limited amount of time also focus their own learning hours. So in a full-time Beit Midrash, but also for those people who are not blessed to have the time to be in a full-time Beit Midrash.
A lot of questions there.
We can take turns.
I don't think there's any one model necessarily. Let's put it that. Let's begin with that. My own learning was essentially I learned Gemara for many years, pretty much exclusively. I got into Mikra in a way by accident. Although, let me say that to me, it is all Torah. I think that one of the distinctions, I'll say, between the academy, university, the learning of that kind of Jewish studies on camp in the academic world, and the yeshiva, is that for the yeshiva it's all Torah. I don't distinguish Tanakh, Chumash, Halacha, philosophy, Gemara. Is, as far as I'm concerned, all Torah. The question is, in terms of a program, I personally am a big believer that you start with the most foundational text. I believe that each has a great value. I believe that the way one studies Tanakh, for example, or Torah, you bring a different set of tools to it. I don't think it's simply applying the same kind of logic and the same kind of approach to the study of Gemara that one does to the study of Chumash. And personally, I've spent a fair amount of time on Chumash and Tanakh. But I think they're all valuable. In terms of what Adrisha we represent, I would say we believe in integrating all the pieces. We believe that each has a value. And if you look at our curriculum and the way we run our programs, it tends to be divided between Gemara is a big chunk. There is also study of Tanakh and etc. So I think that is you know, I would say that within the Ashkenaz world, it's true. With the Balei HaTosfot, they saw that they presented it as if everything is included within the Gemara. My grandfather would say, when you read Gemara, you have all the psukim there. But I would have to respectfully disagree with that approach and say that I don't believe that you can learn Mikra from the psukim and the Gemara. And I think it's a different discipline, and I think they both have a great value. So we try to do both, and precise integration depends on the program, the population. You always have to understand the needs of the student. I don't know if I answered all your questions or not.
And so for a student, let's say, in college full-time who has, let's say, an hour a day to devote to outside learning, do you have personal recommendations for how a person would focus their learning energies?
I would have to know the person. Okay. I don't think there's any one answer. I'm a big believer in, if you're passionate about something, you should pursue your passions. The Balei HaMusar thought you should try to break your passions. But I don't believe it. The Hasidic approach is, if you're called to do something, then you should follow that path. We can't do everything. And if there's a particular something in Torah that you're very attracted to, then you should follow that path and learn it much more deeply and deepen the connection. And if you have a deep connection to one part of Torah, usually it has a very good carryover effect to other learning and to other aspects of the way we are living our lives, which is the real point of learning, I think. It's what you take from it in terms of the time that you're not learning. How do you see your calling? How do you see your service? How do you interact with people, etc.? So I would say to follow one's passions is, if you have a limited amount of time, certainly that's what I would recommend, depending on the person.
Miller, could you also share with us, especially as you mentioned that you work with smicha students who are training to be rabbis, so obviously, you know, maybe their curriculum hasn't changed much in the past years, but maybe it has, and if you could share a bit with us about that.
If I can begin by just continuing Rabbi Silver's direction. Chazal tell us that in adam lomed ele mashalibo chafetz. Rabbi Silber used the term passion. Passion, desire, namely someone has to have a window. There has to be a window that opens up for him to the world of learning. And that window could be anything. It could be Medrash, it could be Halacha, it could be Gemara. Fascinatingly, even though there's a website called LookJet, in which educators talk to one another, and so there was almost a unanimity that Dafyomi makes no sense pedagogically if one only has an hour a day to learn. But the bottom line is that there are hundreds of thousands of Jews to whom this is their window. Namely, it doesn't always go according to that which someone sitting in a school of education may think. It's a question of what touches the individual. And if what touches the individual is feeling part of a larger community, if what touches the individual is feeling that he is taking a walk through Shas, then what happens is that same individual is then going to email a question to his rabbi about something that he saw in the daf, which may relate to some area of halacha lemaaseh, and that's going to bring him to see a pasuk in Chumash. Namely, it's a question just of where to begin, and the where to begin really has to be that sense of where the person naturally is drawn. In moving to the question that you just asked now, in terms of the curriculum for rabbis, this is something which is traditionally relatively set in terms of being able to be a scholar. Someone who can open up a Gemara, who has independent learning skills and is able to teach, and also someone who has at least a certain degree of mastery of the area of halacha. But certainly any rabbi has to be able to relate to a community. So pastoral skills, speaking skills, which I never took, unfortunately, the ability to know how to, at what point one passes issues over to professionals. These are very important for a rabbi to have an awareness of, and we've built all of them into the curriculum, which wasn't in the time when Rav David and I studied. It was sort of felt you just go as a 25-year-old rabbi to a community and somehow you'll pick it up intuitively. So thank God that has changed.
Can I just add to what Rabbi Miller said, just to add one point, which about the Daf Yomi. Actually, my wife wrote an article, which is, I don't know if you saw it or not, she did a Siyum in the summer, the Daf Yomi. And the point that she made about the Daf Yomi, which is about learning, which is a very important point, is that she said, you know, you learn the Daf Yomi. Not every Daf is so exciting, you know what I mean? Some Daf bother you, some Dafim, but there's a basic commitment. That the power of the Daf Yomi is, she compared to, you're committed to something long-term, and that's, I think, in terms of learning Torah, very important, that we enter into it with a sense of real commitment, which means you don't have to love everything that you're doing. But the idea of having a Seder, which I think is, those who have limited time, I would say one of the most important things is to learn every day. That's very important. It could be half an hour, it could be an hour, whatever time one has. But I think the idea that this is a very important part of my day, and something I'm going to do every day and find time and make time, and that's what Daf Yomi has done, I think. It's gotten people to be Kovei Itim LaTorah, which I think is a tremendous gift to the Jewish people. And I think that the Jewish people have responded to that. That's part of learning. Whatever it is, but there should be a Seder and it should be Kavua.
Last year, some of you may have heard, there was a small uproar, let's say, when a number of bishops were invited to Yeshiva University and came to visit the Beit Midrash. Rabbi Miller, could you share what you think about the concept of, say, the sanctity of the Beit Midrash or Kedushat Beit Midrash, and how that would relate to who's invited to participate or to come visit Beit Midrash?
Pasuk that was read earlier spoke about Shivti Beit Hashem Uvaker Vehechalo, that there is a concept also of being a visitor in a Beit Midrash. I don't see a problem of simply giving someone who is a spiritual individual a sense of what we do. I mean, the bishops are basically, or cardinals, I think they were basically blown away, but because they were used to the concept of a library in which people study with a text and with a quiet intensity, and to hear the roar of Torah, the Kol Torah in the Beit Midrash, to see students arguing with one another, to feel that there's something alive, I think just gave them a tremendous respect for Jewish tradition. But really, what you're speaking of in terms of the Kedusha of the Beit Midrash, it's very fascinating that in the concept of halacha, there's a certain balance. That on one hand, the Beit Midrash has more Kedusha than a Beit HaKnesset, because it affects the individual in a broader sense. But on the other hand, there are things that are permitted in a Beit Midrash that are not permitted in a Beit Knesset, because the assumption is that this is the home of the individual, that this is where the student lives. And as such, not speaking about what goes on in the YU Beit Midrash, one's not allowed to bring in a cup of coffee, but halachically, there's not a problem of eating or drinking in the Beit Midrash, even of dozing off, if this is the person's home. So there's a certain fascinating balance between the two. And just as in the world of Batei Knesiot, there is a Jewish center and a synagogue and a shul and a shtibel, and you have different models, so also within the Batei Midrash, you would have that which would be somewhat more formal and that which would be on the other extreme, much more home-like. And they're all valid models as long as they maintain the balance that there is a sense of Kedusha on one hand and a sense of being a Bayit on the other hand.
Do you have something to add?
Well, to bring in visitors, people of faith, maybe a different faith, but people to bring people to see what we do, what a Beit Midrash looks like, obviously I have no problem with that altogether. I wonder whether the question is about visitors or whether the question is about what kinds of activities are appropriate within the Beit Midrash itself, not on the basis of visiting, but for the participants in the Beit Midrash, what kind of learning is appropriate. So I do have a very strong view about that. And the view of Risha is that a multiplicity of views is very important for many reasons. At the end of the day, we're trying to understand a text or a set of texts. We're trying to understand how these texts, what they mean for us, what they should mean for us. There's a sense of being mitzuver, there's a sense of commandedness. And I think it's important in our search for truth, we start with the assumption that no one has the whole truth. That's the first assumption. Sort of postmodern assumption, which I think is not postmodern. I think it's also pre-modern. No one has the whole truth, and therefore we are searching for understanding. And the more different people with different points of view that we are, at least can hear what they say, we all benefit. Someone asked me once about women learning Torah. Is it an issue of Kavadah Brios? I said, no. It's an issue of Kavadah Torah. Because the more people you bring into the process, the more the Torah is enhanced and the better understanding we get. So I think that in terms of the Beit Midrash, in terms of the Kedusha, what it means for me is this. Maybe we'll come back to this later, but I think there's a lot to be gained from the, say, Jewish studies on campus, with the various programs of Jewish studies. What they bring to the table is a distance from the text. They stand back and they ask all kinds of questions that someone who was passionately engaged in learning would never ask, because these are questions from the outside. What the yeshiva brings is a deep love, passion, commitment. I think that fundamentally, a place like Drisha is really a yeshiva, but we also see the value of stepping back, of asking all kinds of questions that is yeshiva bachrim or bachurot will never ask. So I think there is a great value to both, and there's a value to being able to at least hear respectfully what the other person is saying, what the other approach is about, not to accept it, but to be a place where you can hear. And I would say one last point, that Gemara in Brachas, famous story of Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel had a Beit Midrash. He only allowed people in Shetoko Kabaro, what he thought, what people whose inner self is the same as their outer self. Of course, the Gemara asked implicitly the question, how do you know? But that's a different question. And the Gemara says that they deposed him, and they brought in Rabbi Yosef ben Azariah initially. The Gemara says the story that Rabbi Gamliel said to Rabbi Yoshua, what's your view about Tefillat Arvit? Is it Rishut HaChovah? He said, I hold it, it's a chovah. He says, really? They tell me in your name that you hold it to Rishut. So Rabbi Yeshua said, I can't lie. You know, how can I lie to you? You know, if you weren't alive, I could lie behind you, but I can't lie. So Rabbi Gamliel was there, so he made him stand for a long time. People got upset. But the point that one of the points of the story is, why in fact did he lie, actually? It's Rabbi Yeshua you're talking about. He lies to him. But the point is, you can create a base medrash where people are afraid to tell the truth. And I've been in such places, I'm sure many of us have been in such places. You know the questions you're not supposed to ask the Rebbe, because you'd be branded a heretic, this or that. And then what suffers is not just the person, what suffers is the Torah, because the truth can't come out. So you want to create a Beit Midrash where everybody feels they can say whatever they want to say. They should have to defend what they have to say. They can be attacked respectfully. That's all part of Talmud Torah. But you never be afraid to say something, because they'll be branded one way or the other. So I think what's allowed in the Beit Midrash is the things you want to engender. You want to create an environment where no one feels they can't speak up. And that to us is central. There's more to be said about that, but I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. As a sort of continuation of that question, we were wondering about the specific value that you saw in learning in a Beit Midrash as opposed to learning in other settings, whether those settings be a classroom or on your own at home or in some sort of other forum, what specifically a Beit Midrash would contribute to Torah learning, or maybe what other forums would contribute to that. If we're familiar, you could share something about that with us.
Certainly. One knows that on Sukkot there is a mitzvah of Teshuv Kein Taduru, that one's supposed to basically live in the Sukkah. But when it comes to the individual's learning, so then they tell the person he can go to the Beit Midrash. Because it's a qualitatively different experience. It could very well be that when a Rebbe is preparing a shiur, then maybe he has to concentrate, and the din of the Beit Midrash perhaps would not be the best atmosphere for that. But for most of us, as we're growing, a sense to a certain degree of Rabbi Silver spoke about, that the moment that you have Kishem Shepartzufeim Shonot Kach Deoteim Shonot, the moment you have a group of individuals, there's room for a dialogue, there's room for an argument, there's room for a sense of a living Torah, something which is being created within the group, within the community. So on one hand you have a group of individuals, but on the other hand they share a learning community which really links them one to another, and also links generations. In terms of past, present, and future, it's a very. I don't know what Judaism was ever like without a Beit Midrash. I don't know if there ever was a Judaism without a Beit Midrash. We speak about Beit Midrash Shel Shem Ve'Ever, so kind of that the concept of Beit Midrash even preceded Avraham Avinu. But clearly, Yaakov Avinu, with all that he received in the Yoshev Ohalim, of sitting in the house of Yitzchak, but there was something that 14 years he was able to gain in Yeshivat Shem Ve'Ever before being able to go out to the world and to be able to reach the sense of Im Lavan Garti V'Targ Mitzvot Shamarti. So it's a very, very special experience, and I would hope that everyone would be able to participate.
Yeah, I was. In addition to that, I totally agree with that. I think that's actually very important. And as far as the women's institutions are concerned, what most women don't have, actually, maybe this is changing, but certainly the older women, there's no sense of having a Rebbe, and there's no sense of having a real chavrusa. A chavrusa in the yeshiva, I remember when I was sitting shiva this year, and I have a chavrusa in Keren Biavna. I remember about 10 years ago, I went to see him. He lives in Harnov, and Rabbi Melech Langer, he's a very special person. So, but I walk in, I haven't seen him in 25 years, and when you walk in there, it's like I saw him yesterday. There's no time gap. The connection is so deep, because as Rabbi Miller said, when you learn Torah in a real way with other people, you create all kinds of bonds. It's such a powerful thing. That's one aspect of the Beit Midrash. I would add to that in terms of dispositions, which is very important to me. I think the power of being in the Beit Midrash, and I think it's especially important today, is that you go to a Beit Midrash, or say you're a high school grad, or I was say whatever it is, you're junior in high school, whatever, and you go and you have your Rebbe, and then your Rebbe has a Rebbe, and you have all the Bachrim there, and then there's Rosh Yeshiva, and you begin to understand that there are people who dedicate their lives to Torah, many of whom know a lot more than you know, a lot more maybe than you'll ever know. And they have expertise in various areas of Torah. And it allows you to get a sense of one's place, one's true place. I think it encourages the disposition of being a humble person, humility, which I think is probably the most important of all the dispositions. So the Beit Midrash, if you're around big people, great people, honest people, it also creates in you a sense of there's a purity to the learning, there's an integrity, and there's a deep humility. If you learn all by yourself, you live in your own little world without having real access to and learning from such people and seeing them, I think something is lost. So the idea of being in a community of learning, in addition to what Rabbi Miller is saying about having the sense of community with the other person, with your chavruta, with the chevra, also being around people that know a lot, people that are deeply connected to Torah, to the place, I think that's important in terms of our own personal growth as well.
We just heard from one perspective about the place that one learns Torah, but the Gemara focuses on a different question of where one learns Torah. The Gemara highly recommends learning Torah in Eretz Yisrael. I was wondering if Rav Miller could start with sharing a few thoughts on the difference between learning in Eretz Yisrael as opposed to or if there are many more commonalities than we would expect?
It's a question that touches me very, very deeply, because I really feel that we are living in a very, very special generation where the nevuot of Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah are being fulfilled on a daily basis. Namely, that the Ramban points out a number of places in his Perush and also in his famous Drasha on Rosh Hashanah, that we were meant to live in Israel. That's our spiritual home. That's the Kadosh Baruch Hu created the world, created that as our home. And when we're there, the spirituality flows much more naturally. There can only be nevuah in Eretz Yisrael. The whole world of Torah in Eretz Yisrael is organically connected to the people and to the land. And I think the fact that almost everyone here in the room has spent, I hope almost everyone in the room, at least I don't know, in terms of the men who are sitting here, have spent a year or two in Israel before coming here, I think that their experience, well, it's this way. The yeshiva is different because of Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Silber and I learned here in the pre-Eretz Yisrael mode of learning, and in other words, although there were great individuals who were here in terms of Rav Soloveitchik and David Lifshitz, etc., but the concept of of kihem chayenu v'arach yamenu, of being able to sit and learn all day and into the night, an evening seder, the fact that people are in the Beis Medrash on Shabbat, the fact that people look for opportunities to run into the Beit Midrash whenever they have a free time, that all came from Eretz Yisrael. And so, because Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, so therefore this has been exported. But before that movement began, Torah learning in America was of a very, very different nature.
So let me maybe have a slightly different take on the difference between Torah Eretz Yisrael and Torah Chutz La'aretz. To me, what it represents, what Torah Eretz Yisrael, what it's supposed to be, is the difference between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. I think, as far as the Chumash is concerned, so when you're living in Chutz La'aretz, you live on someone else's agenda. You can't live in your own. You live, whether it's Paro, Achashverosh, or whatever it is, one way or the other, you compromise. You make many compromises. You can't live the way you really should be living. You have to deal with the reality of living with the other, and the other typically is not very pleasant. And the Torah of Eretz Yisrael is the Torah of a place where you can make all your own decisions. You're essentially, then therefore you can live. You can live fully. You can live fully in every element of your life, religiously, politically, socially, etc., which is also a great challenge to us, but a great opportunity. And, you know, in terms of, you asked before where Jerusha is headed, what I'm interested in, usually what I'm interested in has some impact the way Jerusha goes. What I'm actually very interested in now is the connection between the Beit Midrash and life. How do we put the Beit Midrash into practice? How do we create a program of learning Torah, which then people take with them, and it has relevance outside the Beit Midrash. It has relevance in all kinds of places where you deal with real problems, issues of health, physical health, mental health, addictions, poverty, aging. What have we learned in the yeshiva that allows us better to deal with these problems? And I'm not convinced it's the content of the yeshiva. I'm more convinced that it's the spirit of the yeshiva. It's the engagement with the other. It's being able to hear, which I think is very important. All these dispositions, and maybe it's the content as well. Maybe there's something about the positions that our tradition has taken, which allows us to better deal with it. So to me, what I call the Torah of Eretz Yisrael is the Torah which addresses every piece of ourselves. And I think the challenge that I feel, and that Jerusha, we feel this challenge, is how can we, the next step is to have a program which engages idealistic young people who want to make a difference in this world, to give them an opportunity to learn Torah, maybe to meet inspirational people, to figure out where, maybe, you know, the Hasidus, they would say, what is God instructing me to do? Our goal is to be God's servants, Avdei Hashem. Each of us has a different service, though. I can't speak for the next person. What is our calling? What is our service? And then to put into play the power of the Beit Midrash, the power of the Torah, take it with us throughout our lives, and to live a full life of service that I call the Torah of Eretz Yisrael, the Torah which speaks to every fiber of us, to all of us, as opposed to the Torah which is in one place. Torah of Beit Midrash, when you walk out, it doesn't exist anymore. So that's the real Torah, I think, the deepest Torah, is the Torah that speaks to us all the time. That's our challenge.
I would just like to second to what Rabbi Silver pointed out. I know it's that in Eretz Yisrael, really the Beit Midrash doesn't have walls. You know, one walks outside and one feels still part of the Beit Midrash in a very real sense. You don't necessarily have to walk to the Kotel, but wherever you're walking is just an extension. As opposed to walking onto Amsterdam Avenue, even if there is a bit of a plaza, one does feel that sense that one has left the Beit Midrash. The Beit Midrash here would be more of an ir miklat to sort of hold you while you are in this in a certain holding pattern in order to be able to energize you when you leave, as opposed to Eretz Yisrael, where it would be a much more organic extension.
We have time for one final question before we open up to questions from the audience. So, last question, if you could share, it's kind of a hard question to pose to someone, but you share your personal opinions on why is it that it's important to even learn Torah? What is it that we gain through our study of Torah?
You would be next half hour.
You decide who wants to go first.
I defer to Rabbi Noah. My mind is terrific. I'm a guest. I'm on the vacuum.
we're both together, Baruch Hashem, in a very, very real sense. That I certainly feel after the dialogue. Kiner mitzvah v'Torah or. Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us a lot of ways, 613 ways of coming close to him. But one of them is the or. One of them is ritzono. One of them relates to that which is Kadosh Baruch Hu's will, and that is Torah. And to link into HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will and to have that privilege of being a partner with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of feeling that which is within us. We have a chelek eloka mima'al within us, and to create that unity is something which Ashreinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us such a gift, halavai, that we would take it more seriously.
Right, so I would say the short and in brief, along the lines that Rabbi Miller is suggesting, I think that at least we are in a tradition which we believe that the human being can be part of Torah, kind of an interpretive tradition, an ongoing interpretive tradition, which gives us, you know, the opportunity to try to address the question that you're asking. How does the Torah speak to us? How does the Torah speak to me today? I'm studying a text that's thousands of years old, but we believe it continues to speak. How is that? How does it speak? What are we hearing? And to put into play the, you know, because the difference between, I said, the academy and the yeshiva is that for the academy, it's a kind of intellectual exercise. But for the yeshiva, it's all about a search for meaning. That's what makes Drisha yeshiva. We're searching, we want to understand what does God impose, and I say impose upon us. We are commanded beings. What is my obligation in this world? And I think that what the Beit Midrash is about, it doesn't always manifest in every detail. You can't find great meaning from every line in the Gemara. But Bigadol, I think, when you look at the totality of it, I believe that it has... I think the question is a very good one, by the way. I think it's a very important question. Sometimes I ask that question myself, because I see people working in the field, working with very difficult populations, doing God's work, and they didn't necessarily learn in yeshiva, you know, but they're doing very good work. So I ask, what added value does the study of Torah bring? I believe it does bring a value both in terms of the content, but even more so in terms of the person. I think learning Torah done properly changes, makes one a better person, a more engaged person, and a more committed person, and allows one to see oneself as being here on earth to serve. So it's not about I'm not doing it to get thank yous, I'm not doing it for gratitude. I'm doing it because that's my job. I think that what emerges from the totality of our text is a tradition in which we are mitzuvim, and we're commanded to do so, and it's an honor to be commanded to do so. And I think that from the totality of our tradition, the totality of the text, we can try to decipher a meaning in these texts and a direction for all of us.
Are there questions from the audience?
Thank you very much. Rabbi Miller mentioned before a new aura of spirituality that you'll feel all over the world today, and something that I've come in contact with in Israel recently is this phenomenon of the Beit Midrash Chiloni, and people who engage in studying Torah in a manner divorced from practice as an intrinsic value in and of itself. I just want to ask, do you have favorable feelings toward that as an intrinsic value, or maybe just as a pragmatic thing to bring people closer to a more committed way of learning Torah?
I don't see two sides. In other words, there's a certain natural effect that Torah has on someone who is learning it. Kodesh Baruch Hu says, "Halavai oti azavu v'torati shamaru," namely that simply being involved in Talmud Torah automatically means that you are engaging in a dialogue with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and engaging in a dialogue inwardly within yourself. Sooner or later, it's going to affect the individual and make him a better person. Whether at what point the individual will will admit that he is being touched spiritually, to use that phrase. So that, you know, there are all sorts of hang-ups that people have, and they don't want to feel as though they're giving up their identity. But the bottom line is that they are doing, at least in this one area, that which a Jew is put in this world to do.
Do you want me to respond to that question?
If you'd like to, I'd love that.
I don't believe that what you're referring to, I'm quite familiar with these places. And we have some connections to them through Drisha as well, Midrashat Aranim, etc. There's Bina in Tel Aviv and Alman. I don't think the way you characterize it is actually precise. It's not that it's disconnected from any kind of practice. The PhD program at Hebrew University is disconnected from practice. The academics, Dafka, disconnect. These places are not disconnected at all. They want to accept Torah on their own terms. They don't want to be Orthodox Jews. But the idea that it doesn't have an impact on them is not at all true. On the contrary, they're looking to see what lessons they learn. They want to put them in place. But they want they have a different set of assumptions about what this imposes upon them. That's all. So I think it's a positive phenomenon, actually. I think it's also an outgrowth of the situation in Israel, where the secular, so-called secular, I don't even call them that, but the so-called Lo Dati made a compact many years ago that you can be Lo Dati, and we'll be Lo Dati, we'll run the country, and you can go in the yeshiva, we won't take you into the army. And that was, to my mind, a terrible mistake, actually, which I think hopefully is beginning to be rectified. I think it's an error, and I agree with Rabbi Miller completely. You know, the more people involved in the learning Torah, taking it seriously, finding meaning in it, only good things will come of that. Where it's going to take us, who knows? But basically, it's good, in my view.
Rabbi Silver, from what I gleaned from what you said so far, I believe that it seemed like most of the chiddush of your program, at least at the beginning, seemed to be, you mentioned the parity and the idea of women on a serious level studying Torah and studying Gemara. So maybe just because I'm not familiar, but why exactly is Drisha co-ed?
Well, Drisha is not co-ed at this point. Why is it not co-ed, you're asking? Why
is
it co-ed?
Because I think...
Now, most of the programs in Drisha are for women. There are some of the programs are co-ed. The majority of the full-time programs are not co-ed.
Okay.
But the reason that it's been shifting over time has to do with the perceived need, the need that we perceive on part of the Jewish community. I think that as women have more, let me make this very clear. It was never women only based on so-called religious grounds that men and women can't learn together. That wasn't based on that. It was based on the reality that the women had very little background in learning. The men had gone to yeshivas. They knew 10 times more than the women. Women didn't know very much. As that changes over time, there's still no parity, but as that changes over time, there's less need for that division, which for us is not based on men and women being separate. So therefore, that's a natural change. It makes total sense where we sit. If you take the position men and women just should be separate, then you're right. They should be just women only. That's not our position.
I've often felt that within a Beis Midrash setting, oftentimes there's a certain pressure to conform in the sense that everyone in a classical Beis Midrash is learning the same Masechet. And I went to yeshiva that had certain siddurim, and everyone's learning the same Masechet at the same time. And oftentimes in classical yeshivas, people oftentimes wear the same clothes. So I'm just curious what role you find for personal expression within a Beit Midrash setting. And I think it goes well with what we talked about with Gemara. I think that's the main thing that was the main thing that we learned in my yeshiva. And I'm just curious how you find that personal expression within learning, you know, obscure passages that oftentimes have very little to do with a student's life.
You brought up a number of topics, Noah, so...
I know.
Let me just say certainly there is a very, very personal element to learning by the fact that we are all different in terms of our nature and our character, and that's what the person brings to the table. What the Beit Midrash does is it tries to meld those personalities into some sort of organic unit, but given the fact that every person is coming to it with his own background and his his own interests. Generally, when one looks for a chavruta that Rabbi Silber very beautifully spoke about in terms of the relationship, one looks for someone who will not be you. You don't want to learn with yourself. You look for someone who has a different character, perhaps looks at things differently, asks different types of questions in order to be able to create a certain energy with being able to confront the differences and to find the common denominator. So I think that if a person has a degree of self-esteem, which is very necessary in order to accomplish anything in life, then he brings that to the table with him, and hopefully he'll be able to find that which will complete him in terms of other people's personalities within the Beit Midrash. In terms of dress is a totally different matter, and it's a question more of various cultural norms rather than anything having to do with the nature of the Beit Midrash. Look around the room. But I do feel that every person comes, every person asks a question from within himself. The question that he asks should not chas v'shalom be, as Rabbi Silber mentioned, that a person would be afraid to say what he feels. A person should be able to express himself, and the moment he expresses himself, that automatically brings the individual into the picture.
We have time for one very quick question because Rav Miller has students waiting for him across the street, so one last very quick question.
I guess it's slightly more directed to Rav Silber, but you mentioned several times that we don't yet have parity in terms of the studying between the men and the women. I guess could you talk about like where we are now and what directions we could go in?
Where we are being the larger Jewish community you're talking about?
Yeah.
Look, I will say one thing about our June program that we've run now three Junes in a row, and it's a co-ed program. That actually is a program where, and I didn't feel any distinction whatsoever in terms of the learning between men and women. I feel it's completely, in that sense, egalitarian, shivya gamre. In terms of parity, it's very simple. The yeshiva yeshiva is not just about learning Torah. The yeshiva, let me be very blunt about this in the spirit of complete honesty. The women, we get at the June some very strong women to learn. Often they go to Israel for 2 years to learn. They go to the places we're all familiar with, Migdal Oz or Nishmat or whatever. And they tend to be strong. But how can you compare this to a guy who went to the Gush? A guy went to the Gush and the average is for 8 years. 8 years, up to the Americans. The average Gush, Hess is only 5 years. The average is 8 years. So the guy coming out of the Gush, not that they all know so much, by the way, but the fact of the matter is, when you learn 8 years, you can't compare. 8 years is different than 2 years. That's number one. The second point of not parity, which is something to think about in terms of what's changed. When we started our COEL in 1984, the women that came, or 1992, we had Scholar Circle. We had some terrific. The women who came to that had one interest, had only one interest. They wanted to learn Torah. They didn't want to make any other changes in the world, just to learn Torah. With more opportunities to learn Torah, the battleground is becoming different, which is the women not just to learn Torah, they want to be full participants in other aspects of Jewish life, including ritual and stuff like that. So the fact of the matter is that I went to Karen Biavne, okay, for 2 years in 1960, I was there during the 60 war, 66 to 68. Most people changed my life. The shiurim were awful, but it doesn't matter. You were there with people that were learning. It was the only yeshiva of its type. There were such serious people there. And what do people remember from Karen Biavne? Usually the davening Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And the fact of the matter is, when I was in Karen Biavne, I was sort of, I never left. I was there for 7 months. I didn't leave one single time. Not Friday, not Shabbos, not Saturday night, never. I was there. The point is, they do the laundry for you. They feed you all the meals. It's a total experience. Okay, there's no kamilus chasadim. But in terms of our Torah and Avodah, the women don't have anything like that. The women don't have this kind of total experience. So in terms of not having parity, the guys are learning many more years, and the guys are learning in a total experience. Davening is very central to the yeshiva. So until those issues are addressed, you never have parity. Now, how one addresses them is a very good question, which isn't enough of the time to deal with that now, nor is that the topic. But you have to be honest about it. There is no parity, but there have been major improvements, which I think Jerusha has been a part of it. Don't take all the credit. The world has changed. To me, the bottom line is, in terms of learning Torah, if you segregate, the more Torah, the better. That's my feeling. The more Torah, the better. I think we can all agree, hopefully, on that. And thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. For people who are interested, there are flyers about lots of programs.
All the time, I mean, like, every time.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Like, is someone.